Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. This week, the Women's Prize for Fiction, formerly the Bailey's Prize, one of the biggest international celebration of women's creativity in the world, announced the 2018 shortlist. On the show ahead, I want to give you a taster of the contenders for this important award, now in its 23rd year. To help me do this, I'm joined by the chair of the judges. She's been a journalist, a novelist, the editor of a newspaper, and now oversees one of Britain's foremost current affairs radio shows. Welcome, Sarah Sands.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'd really like to talk about your history with words. You started off as a journalist.
I did. Actually, originally, I very much wanted to work in publishing, and you needed shorthand for some reason. And the way to get it was to do a journalist course, local newspapers, which I did. And then I sort of stayed where I was after that.
Mm-hmm. And Londoner's Diary, I guess, editing that on the London Evening Standard, the big kind of social page. Would you call that your first breakthrough?
Yes, I'd done some news reporting, but I suppose that was, well, that was also the link, I suppose, with books, because mainly, you know, it was empty fridges and book launches and, you know, stumbling home later. I think they're still doing it. So I sort of lived off, you know, warm wine and canapes for about 3 happy years.
And do you think there's a limit to the amount of time people
can
do that? that you can live off calories? Having done that myself, I think that there's a there comes a time when you just I think I want beans on
there
toast.
There does come a time, I know. I just want to be at home. Yeah. But I think what it does do is it stops you being shy, you know, so that thing that you just have to force your way into conversations, and you get an ear for the quote. And I still think that that's the thing that sort of excites me most, you know, still, you know, on the Today programme, obviously it's the 8:10 and you're waiting for the one quote that will carry, you know, the news agenda for the day, or the quote that's sort of poignant or has meaning. So I think that's another sort of link with books and journalism, that when people speak and it's not sort of practiced and it's not media trained, they just say something that's sort of true or beautifully expressed. Mm. That's what you're waiting for.
Of course, you then went on to edit the paper.
Yes, I did. Eventually, but in a roundabout way. So I left the Evening Standard. I went to work at the Telegraph for a long time. I then made the ascent to be editor of the Sunday Telegraph and then got fired after about 9 months, and then went to the Mail, and then had a very, very happy episode where I thought I found my destiny, which was to edit Reader's Digest. Also, of course, a place that had a sort of word a day. And I became very sort of evangelical about the idea of, you know, stories about people being chased by bears, basically. And then this
I climbed Kilimanjaro without a spleen.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. That's it. You could have done that job. But then, you know, what was sweet about it was sort of pocket size, because blue-collar labourers were meant to have it in their pockets and take it out and learn a word a day. So it was absolutely at the sort of heart of educational improvement and self-improvement. Mm. So that's what I thought Reader's Digest was. But then, of course, you know, it was owned by private equity and they wanted celebrities on the cover like everyone else.
But
so
you know,
I was rather disheartened.
In its heyday,
it was enormous. Biggest magazine in the world.
Growing up in Zimbabwe, for me, it was my link to the world.
Of course.
Was this wonderful link.
Yes, and still that network. So actually, on my first cover, you know, and I could see everyone else putting at the time, I think probably, you know, Kate Moss or Cara Delevingne, and I had Edmund Hillary and thought, you know, that's going to be to my readers. So it did have that great appeal. And actually, when we did some research on who was reading it, in Britain, it turned out to be a lot of Indian anaesthetists. So, you know, there you go.
Fantastic. But a great contribution to the Commonwealth.
Absolutely.
I think.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, maybe that's how it should launch itself now, as a sort of Commonwealth Digest or something like that.
Then you were back at the Evening Standard, in charge, which must have been quite an odd feeling, having been a diarist and then back as the boss.
Yes, I'd done a few steps sort of in between, and I came back actually because the had a new editor and a new proprietor, so it had been sold from the Associated Newspaper stable to the Lebedevs. So that was a sort of, you know, exotic new phase. And there was a new editor. So I was really the sort of safe pair of hands, the only time I've ever been described as that. But anyway, so I came in as a sort of familiar figure who'd worked there before as deputy, into what I thought was, you know, the sort of warm embrace. And then, you know, was taken aside and told that actually they were they were giving this 6 months, you know, it had run out of money, the circulation plummeting, you know, back against the wall. And was I all right with that? And it was a sort of big gamble. The paper went free was what happened. So it sort of found a model that was advertising based and not paying for circulation. So it was a gamble, but it paid off. And I keep making the point, I think it paid off because we didn't know what to do. So we just carried on as before. So it didn't read like a free newspaper. We just behaved as if it were paid for. And so with all the sort of professional pride that goes with that. And so I'm sort of used to a sort of free model a bit. It's free to you, but it's not free. You know, someone's paying for it. That's the thing to sort of bear in mind. Mm. Then I became editor.
And now, of course, it's run by George Osborne, the former Chancellor. I don't really want to talk about politics here, but I wonder what place a former politician has in shaping the agenda of something that most Londoners read.
Well, it's very interesting that he saw, you know, you think, so why did he want it, you know? So I think for two reasons, you know, one was the fun of it. He did say that actually he'd never had so much fun in his life. And I met him for a dinner to discuss, you know, in sort of clandestine dinner to discuss his coming on board. It was at the Ivy. The first person to spot him and come over was Ronnie Wood. And if you'd seen the embrace between these two, and I suddenly thought, oh, you know, so that's what he wants. That. So I think, firstly, he wanted the fun. And then secondly, clearly, he has a strong point of view and cleverly spotted that the Evening Standard was, you know, was the right place, actually. You know, it's a lot of what he believes in chimes with what Londoners want, which is obviously, you know, there remain the sort of openness, the sense of forward looking. So if the Tory party to him felt different, it was a really good platform. And he is someone, of course, who studies power. You know, he's very, very interested in Robert Caro's sort of work on power and Lyndon Johnson and so on, and how you wield it, and not necessarily in the ways that you think, not in conventional ways. So it's quite a sort of asymmetric move by him. I wouldn't know whether it's for keeps or it's for now, but it's interesting. And then, of course, what he brings to it, of course, is an inside knowledge of politics. You know, suddenly these sort of amazingly well-sourced stories, you know, coming out from the Treasury. And you need a reason to, in the attention economy, as we call it, you know, you need a reason to pick up a newspaper. And I think you're always curious about, you know, what he's got, what he knows, once you've decoded it, you know. So I think he's kept it very relevant to the political classes.
Can I respectfully suggest that a clandestine meal is perhaps not to be taken at the Ivy?
No. You'd think, wouldn't you?
Then you made the leap from the private to the public sector and from print to radio. Must have been quite difficult, having worked for a private company, now to be bound by the rules of the BBC.
It really is. And that, I mean, in some ways, in a lot of ways, in most ways, actually, it still sort of fills me with wonder. And I love it that when you go to Portland Place and on the pavements outside, you know, all the sort of names of cities of the world, that sort of, you know, soft power, sort of, you know, benign organisation, and, you know, all those values that it stands for are rather brilliant. You know, I realise it was a bit like going into a sort of nunnery, you know, after being in the Standard, of thinking, I will never be able to get a taxi again. And that there are sort of, you know, certain things you renounce. So all those sort of, you know, trappings of being a newspaper editor, you know, fancy offices and all that sort of thing. And now I have my wet wipes and my, you know, my little patch of desk that I guard jealously. And then, of course, there's the scrutiny, you know, the extraordinary scrutiny. You're at the BBC and you're on the Today programme, which is probably the most sort of scrutinised of all BBC programmes. But I think, you know, it did strike me, you know, after the first sort of shock of that everyone really does feel that programme is theirs, you know. So everyone has a really strong opinion of it and they have a right to, you know. And so actually once you sort of accept that it's a common ownership, you know, I still think someone has to decide the running order each day and not everyone's, you know, will sort of agree with it. But I know that there are things that I watch out for, apart from impartiality, you know, that the listeners don't like crassness, they don't like, they like grammar, they like high standards. And that's sort of reflected in the team if we do make a mistake. And of course, you know, that you're dealing with a lot of material and everyone's, you know, exhausted, you know, because they've, a lot of them have been working all night and so on. Of course you make mistakes, but actually the painfulness, the pain that we all feel when we have made a mistake, I think is a sort of tribute to the sense of sort of obligation to the programme and responsibility and privilege. So I think I would still regard it as an enormous privilege that I'm there.
And that switch from print to audio, is that something that was challenging?
It isn't. I think I would find it much more challenging on television. I think the Today programme is the nearest thing to a newspaper that exists on the at the BBC, you know, for instance, that there's, you know, it has sport and it has business and it has, so it's a sort of mix of subjects in a way that other news programmes don't. And that it has a kind of relationship with newspapers. It has a newspaper and website roundup. You tend to turn often to newspaper commentators on things, you know, that it's the programme where people read the papers most closely. So I think there's got a very close relationship. And it is about the word, you know, coming back to your original opening, you know, that the words matter. It's what you say. It's very, very good for analysis. And it's sort of stripped of some of the distractions that come when you need pictures. You know, that can obviously sort of dictate the stories that you're doing. So discussion is sort of wonderful on that programme. And I still love the idea that you can just get people who know stuff from all over the world, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's about sort of Iran or ants, you know that you can get the top person and they will come on and that you will learn something at the end of the programme. So I sort of think that it hasn't been as difficult as I thought. You know, there's some sort of technical things, obviously. It took me a bit of time, you know, to understand about, you know, pressing buttons to talk to a presenter while they're presenting. Still seems to me, you know, incredibly sort of dangerous thing to do. But you sort of, so you learn all that, you know, and just the whole, the sort of mechanism, you know, and I know now, I guess, you know, how much you can pack in at first, just the sheer excitement that I could, that all these people would come on. So I just kept, you know, putting more and more on. And there wasn't, when I was, you know, listening to the presenters and every item ended, you know, I feel we've run out of time. And I think it was when they said, they were talking about the birth of the cosmos or cosmic dawn and had to go, I'm afraid we're out of time. You know, I just thought, I'm going to have to give them more time, you know, we're going to have to slow down a bit on this. Yeah. So I think, yeah, you pick up, you know, a sense of the rhythm.
You mentioned television there. And of course, you've written a book that has a TV presenter as its main protagonist. Also a book about a gossip columnist. So these are things that possibly drawn from life. So your books, Hot House, and then Playing the Game, and then Villa, which seems to me more about human relationships and family life. With this incredible, busy career, I wonder how your own family life fits around it.
Yes, I think at the time they were fun to write, and I was, you know, pleased to be asked to. I think what I've come to value more and more during my career, and certainly on the Today programme, is a kind of excellence. And I think the difficult thing is to do things fast and be really good. And so, you know, looking back at those books, I remember, for instance, I had a lot of trouble in remembering the characters' names through the book, so they kept changing as far as I remember. And I think that shows a lack of perhaps, you know, sort of total concentration. I would love to write a non-fiction book, actually. I'd love to do a sort of biography or, but they were fun to do, but they didn't take as much time as they should have done, or I'd have liked to have taken.
Presumably quite useful then for you as a judge, judging this amazing prize, to have had that experience that you have.
Yeah, I know it's hard. It's not as easy as it looks. And I think actually, you know, what was sort of particular about this prize in the shortlist was the quality of prose and the sort of precision of language, you know. So if you have slightly dashed off a book, you know, that sense of seeing that the care that has been taken in the writing in the shortlist, you know, and interesting that, you know, some of them are sort of first novelists, and yet I think that the sort of self-discipline in their writing was really striking. So perhaps that's human progress.
Let's go back, because the prize has been running for 23 years with a variety of different sponsors. Give us a taste of its history.
Still, the question that's asked all the time is, why do we need a women's prize? And I guess when it began, it was a sense that women wouldn't get a fair hearing otherwise. And then that women are sort of drowned out in the great sort of scheme of things, that men won prizes. That was the deal. Now, of course, it's different. When I took this on, it was not thinking, here are unheard voices. By the time I got there, I think that these were just brilliant voices. The absolute pleasure, I think I read about 180 books. and there wasn't a dud one among them. And then once you got to the last 50, you're reaching such a standard. So it's just an absolute sort of pleasure of being amongst great women voices.
Do you think that women's fiction differs significantly from men's fiction?
Not particularly. I mean, on this list, on the subjects were very varied. I quite like adventure stories, actually, and there were some terrific ones. Manhattan Beach was one, you know, which was just absolute sort of perfect story. There were quite a lot of women in wildernesses and quite frontier style fiction. I wonder if women had a very good ear, you know, that maybe they're quite good at listening. So the quality of sort of empathy, perhaps, I think, came through. Certainly by the time we got to the shortlist, the way that the sort of expression of grief, for instance, you know, which is a subject of one of those books, you know, was so sort of acute that actually one of the judges was, having read it, just was trying to describe it and started to cry. And she went, this is what grief is. I'm reading exactly what grief is. So to be able to perfectly express grief without the sort of distance, but with that precision is quite a thing. Mm. So I think that's, maybe it's acute empathy, I would say.
Tell me about the other judges then. Was there one that was particularly cantankerous?
No, they were all rather strong-minded, rather. So, yes, they weren't, none of them were going to be doormats in this process. So actually it was quite interesting sort of chairing. I think the fact I kept order very much to my credit. And you immediately saw the different tastes. So actually Imogen Stubbs, who I know of old and probably has a similar, as with me, you know, she quite likes travel and adventure. So I kind of knew what her taste would be. And then, of course, you know, the sort of different perspectives. It was interesting, Anita Anand on the Myrna Kandasamy book, where she said that she sort of particularly recognised this community. This is the one, When I Hit You, which is, you know, shocking book about educated couple in this, a culture of privacy and this horrible coercive control that, you know, will end in violence and does. But she said that it was sort of having the perspective of knowing that culture that added something.
Catherine Mayer, I would imagine, was coming to it from a particularly feminist point of view, given that she's one of the founders of the Women's Equality Party.
Yeah, she was, though interesting, actually, the book I know that she was particularly keen on, Sight, Jessie Greengrass, and that was the one about grief and death and birth. And so I think it was more kind of elemental. You know, with all of them, you wanted strong female characters, you know, I guess. Mm. But no, she didn't start sort of lecturing us all. There was no, there were no protests during the meeting, I think. And then amongst the others, you know, the Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, Imogen Hermes, Goa had sort of particularly supporters because actually it's just such a sort of original tale. So the author used to work at the British Museum and sort of constructed this sort of perfect 18th century sort of Hogarthian world with this courtesan at the head of it. And then you're waiting for the mermaid to appear sort of throughout this sort of freak show of the mermaid. Brilliantly done. And young, you know, sort of young, this ambition and self-confidence, I thought. That was reassuring that there were sort of young people just very sure of what they wanted to say.
I wonder if you even know what it is exactly that you're looking for. And if a book has to be of its time, does it have to be politically relevant? So, for instance, Homefire, Carmen Shamsi's wonderful novel is on there. So politically relevant. Is that important?
It was interesting that, you know, that book was sort of terrific. And I thought, you know, it was a story that was so relevant, could almost have been journalism, except that it told it from the inside and therefore had an ambiguity and a sort of human complexity to it, which gave it a sort of bigger resonance. So it's both sort of bang on topical now and then has a sort of wider resonance. So I think you could read that in 50 years' time and it will stand. So I think that's the test.
We've talked about various books on the shortlist. Haven't yet discussed The Idiot, Elif Batuman.
It's a charming sort of book. I think it's really about the sort of poignant appeal of learning. She's learning about books, she's learning about life. And actually, that was a book that I lent out to a few students who all came back and said exactly how they, you know, she just caught that time of life and the sense of what books can give you and that which you might never have again, you know. So I think that just captured a moment. And she's a beautiful writer and funny. That's another thing. It was good to have some humour.
And Jessamyn Ward, Sing, Unburied Sing.
Yes. I mean, that's an absolute sort of sucker punch of a novel, almost sort of hymn-like in its, in the momentum of it. And actually, I say it's sort of haunting in the book itself. The characters are sort of haunted by the past. You know, it's the whole story of race in American South. So it's a sort of road trip, but, and I think obvious parallels with Faulkner. But it's just fun. I can't stop thinking about that one.
she's American, as we know, and the prize is international. Famously, the Man Booker ran into huge controversy when it opened to Americans. Do you have any similar issues, the fact that you aren't just restricted to this country?
I think first I did think, oh, come on, there are some really good British writers. Why can't it be a British prize? And then you just think, oh, open it up. If you really want the whole depth of the female experience and the female voice and so on, you know, make it worldwide. It's just so much more interesting and so much richer. Mm. But I'm pleased that the Brits did stand their ground in this, that we weren't sort of totally wiped out. We think it's going to be like Wimbledon or something. And, you know, you've just kind of got no hope once the Americans arrive. But actually, there were some really, really sort of good voices. But I think what it gives you is just that richness and variety.
Mm. How much influence do you think literary prizes have? Are they better than reviews? Are they better than newspaper coverage? Although, of course, they do generate publicity.
I think if they make people read books, they're a very, very good thing. And the evidence suggests that that's what happened. So I'm all for them.
Mm. And finally, what will this mean for the career of the winner?
Well, it will be interesting which one. Some are more established than others. So it's either, you know, the sort of huge break, or it's a sort of wonderful endorsement of a reputation, you know, already there. So I think, you know, whatever happens really, really matters.
Well, we found out who that person was at a stunning event this week. On a gorgeous summer evening, it seemed the whole of the British publishing world gathered in beautiful Bedford Square in central London to hear the announcement.
A book that sustains mastery of its themes and its form. A remarkable book, which we passionately recommend. The award goes to Camilla Shand. Yeah!
I spoke to an elated Camilla Shamsi.
You know, I've been shortlisted for it twice before. And I really think the only way to go into a thing like this is, of course, you hope, but you don't expect. And, you know, in your mind, you just decide someone else is going to win. And that's just what's going to happen.
Well, I actually went and had a bet on you because the odds came through and it said that actually you weren't the favourite to win. And I thought, you know what? I just have a feeling about this. She's totally going to win. And so I had a bet. So actually, thanks to you, because I'm so mean, actually, I'm £15 richer.
I hope you're going to buy me a sandwich or something with half your earnings. Although I do think I may have picked up a little more than £15 myself this evening. What a vulgar thing to say, but there it is.
Well, there it is. And in fact, that is the nub of it, that this is the most important and indeed the richest prize for women writers in the world. It's really, really important in that it sets out the fact that here are women who are doing these amazing things.
You know, I've always loved this prize. I've loved this prize as a reader because there are so many writers who've won in the past who I admire so tremendously. I mean, the two times I've been shortlisted and haven't won, the two writers who have won are to me two of the greatest writers in the world today, Marilyn Robinson and Ali Smith. You know, and so that the roll call of winners of this prize is extraordinary, and it's nice to be in their midst.
So how is this going to affect your work in the future?
It's an interesting thing. All kinds of things happen as a writer, but then the moment you sit down to start something, it is the same as it always is, which is you are the writer with some kind of an idea, looking at the blank screen, thinking, how do I get from this idea to a novel? You know, other people's expectations may change, all that may change, but the actual sitting and writing, that is what it is.
This book is amazing, and I really feel that it is perfectly placed at this time. It's captured the zeitgeist. It can really change public opinion. Was that your aim?
I mean, it's a very nice thing to hear. I mean, I think my aim is always to write the best damn book I can write. You always hope that it's going to make people think and feel. And of course, I knew that in this particular case, the subject matter that I was dealing with was something that people were reading a lot in newspapers, but didn't necessarily have sort of deeper stories around. So of course, there's some bit of your brain that thinks, well, it'd be nice if someone who read this started to think differently about things. But really, make this work as a novel was the only thing that was occupying the centre of my brain.
You can hear more from Camilla in a previous episode of Meet the Writers. It's available from our online archive. Let's give the final word to the chair of the judges of the Women's Prize for Fiction, Sarah Sands.
was hard. I won't pretend it was easy, but it's that feeling that it was hard, and actually you feel slightly sad afterwards because of those you had to leave behind, but absolutely no doubts it was the right choice. And actually I was very pleased tonight, because in the end, you know, it was our decision, and then you sort of present it to an audience and the cheers that you heard, that you knew everyone loved this book. So feeling very happy about that.
Was it unanimous?
Yes, it was. It was interesting because it was unanimous in the end, wasn't at the start. So it did require people to talk through why they love the books. So it really is this sort of ritual of sacrifice that, you know, there are books everyone loved. And so they started by, but I really love this book. And then as you talk your way through it and found sort of common ground, you know, that you knew that this was the book that we fastened on at the end that everyone could love. So it was a sort of interesting process. Actually, it's taught me a bit about negotiations.
We started this conversation talking about your life and your work, and I wonder what you take away from this personally.
The thing I've realised is, firstly, how terrific women's literature is, and, you know, not saying that in a sort of platitudinous way, the quality of the prose was extraordinary. So I'm just very, very sort of buoyed up by that. And actually, it's also, there's something about an audience of mostly women that you find here. There was a nice Sunday Times young journalist that I met who was looking around at her sort of, you know, role model. I introduced her to Lise Doucette, and I suddenly thought, you know, we can help each other around here. So I think you start with a sense of sort of good nature, and, you know, it's more fun. It's much more fun than some of the other prizes I've been to or been involved in. So I feel tremendously warm about other women tonight. That's what I feel.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.